Good afternoon. I'll call to order this meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson here.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins. Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegarde.
Lislegarde present.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Here.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson excused. Representative Tice.
Present.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley.
A quorum is present. The first item on our agenda today is approval of our minutes from our last meeting. Representative Katiza Watoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes from our March 10th meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move the March 10th minutes.
Any discussion to the Katiza Watoon motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes from March 10th, 2021 are approved. We do have a busy agenda today. We do have the ability to go into the evening at 7 o'clock tonight, but I'm hopeful that we can be efficient and expeditious and finish up at 4:30 in our regular committee time. But it will require everyone's cooperation, I suppose. The first item on our agenda today is House File 2056. Welcome to the committee, Representative Howard. I will move that House File 2056 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Representative Howard, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it feels good to be back with the old gang a little bit.
We miss you.
Yeah, that's right. This is the first time I've been before the committee, so glad to be here. Members, House File 2056 is a bill that deals with access to affordable prescription drugs. And, you know, over the last couple years, as you all know, the legislature can be a contentious place. But what I want to call attention to is the great bipartisan work we have done over the last 2 years when it comes to prescription drugs. Over the last biennium, we passed nation-leading legislation to reform how we treat pharmacy benefit managers. We passed a price transparency law, and of course we passed Alex law to ensure that Minnesotans aren't losing their life because they can't afford their insulin. These were all tough tasks, but ultimately with bipartisan support, we passed good legislation that's in the best interests of Minnesotans. And I believe this bill, House File 2056, is an excellent next step in our work to make sure that Minnesotans have access to affordable prescription drugs, especially those that are life necessary as they treat chronic conditions. House File 2056 would place a co-pay price cap of $25 to help cover Minnesotans with chronic conditions related to diabetes, asthma, and EpiPens. Insulin has gotten a lot of attention and due weight over the last several years about the high cost, and the same can go for EpiPens. In your written testimony, Ms. Catherine Bone testified that the pack of EpiPens that her family used to pay $30 for now costs $1,500. And I've heard from folks, the statistics of folks that are managing asthma are also dealing with very high out-of-pocket costs. And so what this bill would do would place ensure that for state-regulated health plans, they would pay no more than $25 a month for their prescription drugs. Importantly, this bill would also include medical supplies. For anyone that's had conversation with folks that are managing type 1 diabetes, you know that it's not just the prescription drugs that come with the cost of families. The supplies also can be pricey. And in some families, they pay more for their supplies than they actually do for the prescription drugs. And this is particularly true for families. And so, again, the goal of this bill is to provide more consistency and affordability for some of the most important important or chronic conditions that face Minnesotans. And I do want to mention that this isn't a bill, ALEC's law was something that we did here in Minnesota first, and now other states are following suit and looking at it. This is actually something that other states have implemented, and Minnesota is kind of behind the curve. Colorado and Illinois have implemented laws in recent years, and over 30 states, mostly with bipartisan support, are considering such a change. And I do want to mention and credit health plans in Minnesota voluntarily on something like insulin. A couple years ago, they decided to voluntarily cap their copays at $25. That's wonderful provides consistency for that year for that family that might be on one of those health plans. But what this bill would do would give a peace of mind and some assurances that that copay will stay at that level. But I'll say that the move voluntarily to do that by the health plans in recent years hasn't come with some exorbitant shock to the system, to premiums, et cetera, and underscores that this change in actual practice is warranted without some of the kind of negative consequences that we may hear. But and then lastly, just want to mention this bill isn't a solve all. It's one piece of our work to make sure the prescription drugs are affordable. But over the last few years, I think what those of us that are working in this arena see is that we need every actor in our prescription drug system to have a role in solving this problem, from our drug manufacturers to the PBMs to our health plans. And this asks health plans to have a role in that by capping copays at $25 for medication that Minnesota families need to survive. And so as we've done in previous sessions, would encourage bipartisan support as we work to make this a reality for Minnesota families. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier, Ms. Munson.
All right. Kim Munson is on the list. Ms. Munson?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kim Munson, and my husband and I, along with my two daughters, live in Lakeville. Today, I speak before this committee as a mother to a 9-year-old child with type 1 diabetes and a wife to a husband with a deadly shellfish allergy who must carry an EpiPen at all times. I am here in support of House File 2056, and I'd like to share a few reasons why. I am pleased to hear this bill addresses both the outrageous costs of prescription drugs and medical supplies by instituting a copay cap. We know that the cost of prescription drugs continues to rise at a much greater rate than inflation. In January of just this year, according to GoodRx, 832 drug prices increased by an average of nearly 5%. Inflation hasn't even hit 2%. I have been a diabetes and prescription drug advocate for 5 years now, and I have yet to see the list price of one drug ever decrease. For our family, however, the cost of my daughter's diabetes supplies costs far more than her prescription drugs, unfortunately. That is why I am so pleased to hear this bill include the cost of medical supplies. It drains our checking account every month. She wears both a continuous glucose monitor to alert us of her lows due to hypoglycemic unawareness and an insulin pump, which greatly enhances her quality of life. But it comes at a tremendous financial cost to our family, especially when I just found out I will soon lose my job. I believe in shifting the cost sharing for medications and supplies for chronic conditions like diabetes, asthma, and allergies, because that is ultimately why people purchase health insurance. Why else do people purchase health insurance? Ultimately, it is to share the burden of costs. According to JAMA, some health insurance companies are doubling their profits in the billions, in part due to COVID, but even before the pandemic, profits were obscenely high. But people with chronic conditions often don't have a limitless pot of money to afford the medications and supplies they must purchase in order to live. We must have a consistent, reasonable, and manageable copay for budgetary purposes each month, and oftentimes we just don't. You might say, with regards to insulin specifically, that many insurers have voluntarily capped the insulin copay in Minnesota. My answer is that they should have no problem codifying copay language into law. Additionally, Now is the time to enact a copay cap for asthma and allergy medications. Asthmatic and allergic reactions can be deadly, and like our family has learned when purchasing EpiPens, the cost is outrageous as well. Lastly, with regards to drugs specifically, it is worth noting that many health insurance companies contract with pharmacy benefit managers that in turn receive millions in manufacturer rebates for having drugs like my daughter's Humalog and Lantus and my husband's EpiPen on their formulary. In other words, they get paid money in the form of rebates for having certain drugs covered. So will health insurance companies really suffer by ensuring that their members have access to the drugs they need to simply live, like the constituents in your districts who are choosing between food and rent or their medications and medical supplies? I don't think so. I'm still waiting for federal legislation that will finally get to the heart of the prescription drug and medical supply issue in America. I'm afraid my daughter's life will depend on it someday. Until then, states like Minnesota must lead the way to help as many people as possible, and this bill does exactly that. It will significantly reduce the cost of prescription drugs and supplies for Minnesotans on state-regulated insurance plans with chronic conditions like diabetes, asthma, and allergies, and that is why I support it. Thank you for your time, and I ask for your support on House File 2056.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next we'll move to public testimony. The only public testifier that signed up is Dan Andreessen from the health plans. Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I met with Representative Howell this morning, and we met last session on this issue when it was part of the insulin bill. I appreciate him reaching out and completely agree with the concerns raised about the increasing cost of prescription drugs, especially for those drugs which are life-sustaining for diabetes, asthma, and allergies. The average list price for insulin increased 11% annually from 2001 to 2018. Prices for asthma inhalers increased 35% from 2013 to 2018. And we all remember the issue with EpiPens in 2016 when Mylan acquired EpiPen and raised prices from $57 to more than $600, and Mylan officials were brought in front of Congress for price gouging. As health plans, we try to manage drug benefits so that enrollees can afford access to the medications in the face of these price increases. As was mentioned last year, council members independently and voluntarily lowered insulin co-pays for plans in the fully insured market to $25 or less. Some are at zero. However, we are opposed to the approach in House File 2056 to permanently place these co-pay levels in statute for these three drug classes. If copays are capped at $25 without any other downward pressure on manufacturers to decrease their prices, health plans will likely have no choice but to shift these costs to premiums. Premiums and copays are a reflection of the cost of healthcare, and in this case, the price of prescription drugs, and manufacturers set those prices. A cap on copays would only work in containing costs if drug companies were to, in turn, freeze their prices. Manufacturers have given no indication the prices will ever be lowered, and past behavior predicts that prices will continue to rise. I also want to remind committee members that House File 2056 would only apply to the fully insured market and to CGIP, the State Employee Group Insurance Program. This legislation would not impact co-pays for those receiving their insurance through a large employer in the self-insured market. We look forward to working with Representative Howard and others in developing innovative solutions to put downward pressure on the price of prescription drugs. And we urge a focus on the root cause of this problem and the prices set by drug manufacturers. Thank you.
Thank you. That's the end of public testimony. We'll move on to amendments. Representative Rasmussen, Representative O'Driscoll, are you wanting to ask a procedural question or do you have more comments to the bill?
Mr. Chair, I just have a few comments, as I know a couple of my members do to the bill. So we'll wait for amendments. Thank you.
Sounds good. So we will move to amendments. Representative Rasmussen, I believe you have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment and describe it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move the A1 amendment.
Great. To your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A1 amendment would add Representative Elkins' House File 55 to the bill before us. We have discussed this language before, but as a reminder, House File 55 requires that mandated health benefit proposals, like the one before us, be evaluated by the Commissioner of Commerce to determine the public health and fiscal impacts of the mandate. This is a good government amendment that seeks to ensure members are fully informed of the impacts of the mandates they intend to pass. As we review Representative Howard's bill, I wish this committee had the information that House File 55 would provide to make a more informed decision. The language in this amendment has broad, bipartisan, bicameral support and would help us better manage the costs of health insurance. I would humbly ask Representative Howard to consider this a friendly amendment to help move this important legislation forward.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Representative Rasmussen, for bringing the amendment forward. I don't sit on Commerce, so I haven't heard this bill before. The bill before us is about a half page, and so I'm reluctant to add an entire another bill and onto this bill. But I'm more than happy to have a conversation offline as this legislation moves through the process. But I would encourage members to oppose the amendment.
Discussion to the amendment. I think, Representative Driscoll, you indicated your comments were to the bill. Representative Haley, Representative Dabney, if either of you have comments to the amendment, let me know.
Representative Haley? Mine are to the bill, Chair Stevenson.
Okay. Representative Dabney, are you to the amendment or to the bill?
Mine is to the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I'd simply say that good government is one that listens to its citizens and constituents. Putting artificial processes between constituents and elected officials who are there to do their bidding wouldn't be our best choice. Let's be gentle here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Just to the amendment, I want to thank Representative Elkins for being the author of House File 55. As Representative Dabney pointed out, government, putting government between its people and what have you. I do believe that the Elkins bill is a very well thought out bill. It establishes a procedure that all stakeholders can have an input in and that all stakeholders can have a chance to walk through peaceably and with the benefit of time to be able to look at the costs and impacts on this. Representative Rasmussen, thank you for the second time this session for bringing that amendment forward. It's unfortunate that we did not have a hearing on this bill. But Representative Rasmussen, again, I underscore the importance of this, and I thank you again, Representative Elkins, for thinking about the importance of this. Representative Rasmussen, I'm not sure what your intention is on this, but again, good job today for offering such an amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion to the amendment?
Mr. Chair, can I have that last word on the amendment?
You certainly can, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss the A1 amendment today. I hope that this committee will revisit House File 55 and give it the consideration it deserves. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. No further amendments, so now we will move to member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Howard, for bringing this forward. I think one of your testifiers may have stated this, but can you repeat it for me? Because I was looking in the language, want to be clear. Which health plans would your bill apply to and which wouldn't it?
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Haley. This would apply to state-regulated health plans. It would not apply to federally regulated or ERISA health plans, which is a significant amount of the market, but there's also a significant percentage of Minnesotans that receive state health-regulated insurance.
Representative Haley, any follow-up?
I have an additional question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Howard. And then my second question was for the testifier, Mr. Andreessen. We all share the concern about rising healthcare costs, and I'm interested in how our reinsurance program that we successfully instituted a couple years ago and is coming up for renewal, how the reinsurance program maybe has impacted these copay costs, if Mr. Andreessen could address that for me.
And I'm happy to let Mr. Andreessen answer that question narrowly tailored to the question. I don't want to have a broad discussion about reinsurance today. We will have a discussion about reinsurance in this committee. I commit to you that, but you narrowly tailored it to the bill before us, and I'm fine with him answering to that point. Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haley, I would say that when our plan members made this decision a while back, you know, it certainly did help that reinsurance was in place, because reinsurance does help pay for a lot of costs when it comes to insulin and other health care costs relating to diabetes. So that certainly helped with the decision-making point that to keep those co-pays low or maybe zero in those cases.
Representative Haley.
No further follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill author, just a couple of questions and then a couple of comments. First of all, Representative Howard, I do appreciate your endeavors from last year with insulin and your endeavors this year for trying to find solutions. Is there a Senate companion to this bill?
Representative Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I don't know if it's been introduced yet. I know that a senator has the yellow jackets and with the intention of introducing. It may very well have been introduced. I'm just not certain. If it did get introduced, it was shortly, just this week probably.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howard, I won't be supporting your bill today, and it's I want to just give you some thoughts on what could help me support a bill like this. If it was more in the keeping with what Representative Elkins is doing in House File 55, and I know you said you haven't been on Commerce, very quickly, what that amendment that was offered and what Representative Elkins' bill is, it says let's build a framework so that when we have these questions and detect these kinds of things in the marketplace, we bring them to a working group, a study group of professionals who are working on this so we can get all inputs on this, and we can then go to the legislature with a recommendation. I fear that if we were to take your bill and it becomes law with a $25 copay max on here, what happens if copays go away? What happens if copays change? Codified in statute, we have an antiquated number. In the health insurance market and in the health care market, and also consequentially the health insurance market, we have a lot of dynamics that are moving here. And you've been around here both as a staffer and now as an elected member, and you have seen the arcane stuff that is in our state statutes because of endeavors where we didn't anticipate what the future was going to look like. I really don't want to put into statute something that we don't have the flexibility and the dynamics to be able to keep up with what's going on, and having to have that as state law when here's where the statute is and everything else is moving this way. Again, I do laud the efforts of what you're looking for. Sitting down with the industry folks and in a formalized way with a prescribed process, I think saves a lot of political angst for people and actually gets to the solution of things that Ms. Munson was talking about here today, and actually gets the people, as Representative Dabney says, what they need. I just don't know that your bill does that today. So, Mr. Chair, again, with that, the bill author wants to make a few comments in reactions to my bill, but unfortunately today, Representative Howard, I was almost going to call you Senator Howard. I didn't mean
to. No, you don't impugn motives or characters in this committee.
I apologize for that. But my point being, I think you're on the right track with the idea, but I think it's the wrong bill at the wrong time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I don't see any other members seeking recognition, so Representative Howard, if you wanted to respond to Representative O'Driscoll, and then also any closing comments at the same time, I'll turn the floor to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just thank you for your comments, Representative O'Driscoll. And I will say I am flexible to continue working with folks on this bill, both the important stakeholder of Minnesotans who are having to bear the brunt of these high costs, and then the health plans, and had a good conversation this morning about that. And just in particular on that note, I would, and I mentioned this to Mr. Andreessen when we talked, when we talked to the health plans over a year ago about this, the same, I'm all ears in terms of suggestions, in particular suggestions that would help bring manufacturers a little more in line and part of the process, since that's kind of the main sort of hypothetical concern that the copay pressure is a sort of a free rein for drug manufacturers to raise prices. And so I'm very open to working together on what sort of policy solutions we can bring to bear on that front. And what I would say, again, I think we had some really good bills that have been introduced by legislators this session. Representative Elkins has a number of them, although I need to bone up on this one we're discussing today. I know I'm a little more familiar with a few of his other prescription drug bills. But again, we need to make sure that every actor in our healthcare system has a stake in making sure that prescription drugs are affordable, especially those that are life necessary, as we've heard from our testifiers. And so I guess as a way of closing, what I'd leave you with this is that the families that we hear from, just imagine the anxiety of month to month having to manage asthma for your daughter or managing insulin for your family, or wondering if, as the testifier submitted, having to choose between covering which child with EpiPens, just that kind of anxiety on a sort of day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year basis is so much for families to bear. And what this bill does is provide some assurances, some peace of mind that going forward that your family will be able to afford the prescription drugs you need. And so thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the members of the Commerce Committee for the discussion today.
Thank you, Representative Howard. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2056 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Fatiza-Watun.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Haley.
No.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
With 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 2056 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Howard. The next Thank bill you. On the agenda is House File 1950. Welcome to the committee, Representative Ryer. I will move House File 1950 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Ryer, I understand you also have an author's amendment. It's the A1 amendment. I'll move the A1 amendment. Did you want to describe the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to. It is a simple amendment, just adding an effective date that the section will be effective the day following enactment.
A good, simple amendment. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. Representative Ryer, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, committee members. It's good to be back here again, and I appreciate the opportunity to introduce this bill to you today. House File 1950 modifies the Minnesota non-forfeiture law, which guarantees value for individual deferred annuity owners who cancel their contracts while also protecting the insurer from the risks and costs involved in issuing an annuity. The current minimum guaranteed interest rate on deferred annuities is set at 1%. This was established when interest rates were 8 to 10%. Now interest rates are at sustained historic lows, and the Treasury Department has signaled that it has no intention of raising interest rates in the near future. As a result, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has asked states to reduce the statutory non-forfeiture interest rate to 0.15%. This change will only apply to newly issued annuities, and there is no cost to the state. As noted previously, this bill has been amended to become effective the day following enactment. I'm pleased to author this bill because it ensures that an important retirement resource for consumers remains available and affordable. And it has bipartisan support in the House and Senate, including co-author Representative Rasmussen. Next, Commissioner Grace Arnold is here to explain the bill in more detail, and staff are available to answer technical questions as needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Ryer. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold. I'm the temporary commissioner of the Commerce Department. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Ryer for authoring this bill. As she noted, it's simple but important. The NAIC has model laws which are sort of standards that allow for some consistency across states in insurance law. And This one is particularly focused on annuities and allows insurers to continue to sell annuities in a prudent manner during a challenging low interest rate environment. Many states are expected to adopt it this year. The annuity non-forfeiture law has been in place to guarantee value for individual deferred annuity owners who cancel their contracts while protecting the insurer from risks and costs involved in issuing an annuity. As the representative noted, this proposal is driven by the current low interest rate environment and the expected continuance of that environment in the foreseeable future. The higher guaranteed rate on this aspect of the surrender rate is then that means that there it lowers the ability of the insurer to provide attractive benefits in the other aspects of the annuity, which is typically a lifetime income. Low interest rate environment means that there are low yields available to insurance companies to support these types of products. Without the change to law, it's likely that many life insurers would stop selling certain products that are critical components of many Minnesotans' retirement plans. The annuity market is very competitive, which means that if the environment changes, life insurers are likely to increase their guaranteed interest rates. So I'd like to thank Representative Ryer and Chair Stevenson. I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Arnold. There are no further testifiers to the bill, no public testimony to the bill, so we'll move to member discussion and questions. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Ryer and the Commissioner Arnold for this bill today. It's as a member of the Commission on Pension and Retirement, you know, annuities is a really important piece of our guaranteed income opportunities, especially for individuals who don't have access to a pension. And so really appreciate the work being done here to help ensure that annuities have a place in the marketplace when it comes to retirement products.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Seeing no further members seeking recognition, Representative Ryer, any closing comments?
No, I just thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank the committee for your attention and your support.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Hearing no additional discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 1950, as amended, be recommended to be referred to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Katisa-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
And Representative Lilly.
With 15 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails, and House File 1590 is, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. The next bill on the agenda is House File 832. It's Representative Katisa-Watoon's bill. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Katisa-Watoon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move that. House File 832 be laid over for further consideration.
Yes, and just for the committee's benefit, the idea here is that there's a couple of amendments today that we're going to take on, one of which came relatively late in the process. Since we have the time to set the bill aside until Friday, we will do so that members can review the amendments carefully, and we'll plan to vote it out of committee on Friday. So why don't we do the amendments? We'll do the author's amendment. We have an author's amendment. It's the A2 amendment. Representative Katisa-Watoon, would you like to move and describe your amendment?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the A2 amendment, the simplest way to explain the A2 amendment is that the bill is trying to privatize additional lottery winner data, and so the A2 amendment is necessary basically to maintain the existing statute for these secondary prize drawings. So in this essentially, yes, this amendment is not actually changing anything in current law, but it is necessary given the fact that we're trying to make additional privacy changes on the rest of the lottery prizes.
Great. So any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none. Oh, Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, I see that Mr. Prock is here from the lottery. Maybe he can tell us what the issue is that brought the amendment forward for clarification for members.
Mr. Prock?
Sure. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the bill author for the amendment. This amendment is really about our second chance drawings at the lottery. Some of you may be familiar with if you have a scratch ticket that's a non-winning ticket, we have an opt-in option often. That's a promotional option where you can fill out your name on the back of the ticket and send it in, and we give away some promotional prizes. Sometimes they're smaller things like grills or tickets to the wild game. Sometimes they're large, like a truck or a fishing boat. But these are promotional items that we use. The issue with privatizing these names, unfortunately, there are a lot of lottery scams out there. And so we follow best practices and we say, if we call you to say that you've won one of these prizes, you've won a grill, please go verify that this is accurate on our website so that you know that it's true. And we would do that when we call anyone. And so this gives us the option to say anybody who calls you will be verified through the website on these smaller or bigger second chance prizes.
Representative O'Driscoll, anything further to the amendment?
Yeah, that's very helpful, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Prock, I just have one follow-up to help with clarification on that. So the bill itself talks about allowing or saying that if you're a lottery winner, your data will be private. There is, I think, another amendment that we'll be taking up that will say that person can opt in. Does the A2 amendment say that if you fill out the back of the lottery ticket and send it in, that you're waiving your right to privacy, in essence, opting out of your right to privacy? When your folks would call and verifying your name on the website, that's kind of viewable, a condition of the second chance prize drawing?
So for practical purposes, I apologize. Mr. Chair, yes, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, Mr. Chair. For practical purposes, what the amendment would do would just say if you opt into one of these second chance drawings, your name would be public and we would post it on the website for people to see. Again, these are completely optional promotional things that we do all throughout the year. And this is just a transparency way that we can help protect against some of those unfortunate scams that are out there.
Representative Kuhn, did you also want to address that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I also did just want to point out that the second chance drawings, the way that we have worded the amendment, that they apply to items that are not cash prizes. So, I mean, the overarching privacy bill will apply to the large cash prizes that are available. The primary reason why people enter the lottery, and then if they choose to opt into the second chance, that's for the promotional items that wouldn't be cash winnings.
Anything further, Representative O'Driscoll?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. That provides clarity. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Barr, are you seeking to speak to the amendment or to the underlying bill?
The amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a point of clarification, I guess maybe not even clarification, but suggestion, the author had stated there's possibly another amendment coming that I didn't see listed here. Doesn't this amendment, as worded now, the A2, doesn't this actually limit to only non-cash prizes? So if the lottery sometime in the future decided that we've got a big lottery thing that has a grand prize of $100,000, register for a second chance at $20,000 or something like that as a cash prize, that would not be covered in this case. So wouldn't taking cash, large cash prizes out of here and just putting a period and saying that any second chance drawing prize period would be covered under privacy stuff to make sure that going in the future, the lottery would have options?
And Representative Barr, before I turn it to Representative Katiza Watun to answer, the other amendment she's referring to is the A1 that Representative Farr, I believe, is offering. And if you like, we can make sure that it's posted on the page, but we can also send it to you if you want us to send a copy. Just let us know. Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Barr, for the question. So the intent for this amendment, so the intent for the bill, as we'll get to eventually after the two amendments, is to wholly privatize people's information, just because, you know, it's so easy to find people's information on the internet. We certainly know that as elected officials, that our information is out there and people can find it with relative ease. And so this, for lottery winners, there is you know, sometimes like the curse of winning the lottery. And so some of the higher profile things that have happened is that, you know, people have been targets of online catfishing scams and then kind of swindled out of some of their winnings through like fake relationships online, or some people have even been murdered. So when we're trying to privatize the cash based winners information, we want to specify that if there were cash offerings through the second chance, that those would also be private. And so likely going forward, the lottery may or may not choose to do a cash-based second chance drawing. So it would be limited to the promotional items of non-cash circumstance.
Any follow-up, Representative Barr?
Just real quickly, Mr. Chair, to the bill author, I agree with the intent. I do believe that it all should be private. I was just referring to this specifically. It says if there's a second chance cash, that would not be covered. If the lottery decided to do that sometime in the future, that would not be covered under this. And I wanted it to also be covered, as opposed to grills, cars, things like that. If there was some kind of cash option that they decided to do in the future, I wanted that to also be covered with privacy.
So just as a reminder to all members also that the we're not going to vote the bill out of committee today. We have it until Friday. So I also think that maybe Representative Katiza Watun and Representative Barr, you can talk about that issue a little bit offline and see if there's a way to accommodate that that concern. Representative Lucero, are you wanting to speak to this amendment as well?
Correct.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just point of clarification. So I understand non-cash second chance prizes in this case, just for my own clarity then. So I understand that what was being described there in terms of the need to verify through the website and having disclosed information. But then as I understand it here, then the people's names would automatically be publicized on the website. Do they have the option to opt out of that? And or so that's number one. Second question is, why don't we make it uniform across the board? So it's automatically permissive to authenticate or to verify if needed, but then have that information be private, even if it's non-cash.
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great question, Representative Lucero. I think, as Mr. Prock had mentioned, so the second chance drawings are only, by choice. So, I mean, people can choose if they lose the main game that they choose to buy into, they can submit their information. And the only way to verify that they've won after that is to put their first and last name out on the website. So then they can go to the website and double check. And so they're, essentially opting into that second game. They don't have to do that. And so then, yes, if they choose to do that, that is the way that we would verify if they were the winner.
Okay, it looks like Representative Lucero is okay. Good. Yeah, okay. Any further discussion to the A2 amendment, which is an author's amendment, getting the bill in the shape she'd like the committee to consider it? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. It's a little odd to ask Representative Katiza Watun to describe the bill after we had such a lengthy discussion about it during the author's amendment phase, but I don't want to deprive her the opportunity to make opening remarks. So Representative Katiza Watun, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, on the whole, this is a quite simple bill. The original bill, previous to being amended, was like a one word change to statute, just adding somebody's name to the private data that is not released by the lottery. And I will allow Mr. Prock to talk a little bit more about kind of how the lottery has changed the structure of private information being released as technology has continues to change. But essentially, we just want to make sure, Senator Kiffmeyer and I want to make sure that everyone's privacy is of utmost importance, that we're keeping Minnesotans safe should they choose to participate in the lottery, and that their information is slightly less easily accessible. So keeping that information safe and sound.
All right. We do have the one testifier who's already introduced himself, Mr. Prock.
Hi. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I know you've got a packed agenda, so I'll be really brief. For the record, my name is Adam Prock. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Lottery. Thank you for the opportunity to briefly discuss House File 832. First off, I'd like to thank the author and this committee for today's amendment, which will allow us the flexibility to continue to offer promotional drawings that Minnesotans enjoy in a secure and transparent way. Thank you. As I've testified before, the balance between lottery integrity and player security is something we consider every day at the lottery. Both are vital to our mission as a state agency. We appreciate and share your commitment to the safety and security and integrity of the Minnesota Lottery and its players. Even with today's helpful amendment, we continue to have concerns with the transparency around winner anonymity. We appreciate the author's willingness to work with us and are hopeful that we'll find further ways to improve this bill so we can reach our shared goals. Thank you very much. I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Prock. And no members of the public signed up to testify. We do have one other amendment that was submitted. I alluded to it earlier, and so Vice Chair Katusa-Watoon. Representative Farr, I believe you're offering the A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment and describe it?
Yeah, I would move that amendment, and it is even simpler than the bill. It is just allowing the winner the option to opt in to having their information be public.
Thank you, Representative Farr. Representative Katusa-Watoon, any comments to the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Farr, for bringing this amendment. I think that it does allow additional flexibility for the lottery itself and then for winners who, should they choose to want to be Instagram famous, shall we say, for participating in some of those marketing opportunities, it allows them the opportunity to do so. I would accept it as a friendly amendment.
All right. Any further discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. There are no further amendments. Any discussion or questions to House File 832 as amended?
Mr. Chair, just one quick question, Representative
O'Driscoll.
If in the interim, based on the conversations we were having with Mr. Prock et al. And the bill author, are we going to be able to entertain some refining amendments if that's needed on Friday?
I think that if there are limited refining amendments, we probably would allow that based on the discussion today. I probably would not be inclined to allow, major substantive amendments that take the bill in a direction outside the discussion today.
I think we're in agreement. Thank you, sir.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate this bill, but I also appreciate the amendments because my son is using me as his retirement, and he expects that I'll be winning the lottery soon, and that way I can promote his new ventures if I choose.
Or keep your lottery winning secret from your son.
Or keep them secret from him.
Yeah, you don't have to tell him. There you
go. I will.
All right. Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Lucero, did you work for the lottery?
No, I didn't, but it's funny you say that because I worked at the Burger King that's literally one block away from the lottery headquarters there in Roseville.
All right, hold on one second. Representative Cagle, did we already have that one?
It's already on the list.
Oh, we already had that one.
Okay. I do have the question I was going to ask along the same lines of Representative Tice is if we go in as a committee pool, like an office pool, and we all win the lottery, are we all going to resign from the House at the same time, or how would that work?
You first. okay. Seeing no further discussion to the bill, Representative Katusa-Watoon, any further discussion?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate member support.
All right. With that, would you like to renew your motion?
I would renew my motion that House File 832 be laid over for further consideration. And thanks for the conversation today.
All right. Vice Chair Katisa Witun renews the motion that House File 832 as amended be laid over for further consideration, and the bill is laid over. The next item on the agenda is House File 1913, Representative Elkins' bill. Representative Elkins, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'll move that we refer this bill to the general ledger, general register.
All right. Representative Elkins moves House File 1913 be placed on the general register. There is an author's amendment labeled A1. Representative Elkins, would you like to move and describe that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is pretty much a technical amendment. It just corrects internal references within the bill. There really aren't any substantive changes in here.
Any discussion to... Oh, sorry, Representative Elkins.
I thought you... Go ahead and I'll move the approval of the A2 amendment.
Representative Elkins moves the... Is it, it's the A1, isn't it? You said A2.
I think it's A2.
Could our committee administrator pop in here and let us know which one we actually have?
So I'm holding an A2 in my hands.
Now look at what we have posted here.
Let's see.
Mr. Chair, members, it is the A2.
It's the A2, so I stand corrected. Representative Elkins moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the A2 is adopted. Representative Elkins, to your bill.
This is another National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Act. This one deals with data security, and Commissioner Arnold is going to describe this bill in more detail.
All right, Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold. I'm the temporary commissioner of the Department of Commerce. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Elkins for authoring this bill, which makes important updates to how the Commerce Department and our regulated industries work together to protect consumers' personal data. As Representative Elkins mentioned, this is a National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Act, which means that it's been through a vetting process that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners industry and regulators have had a chance to weigh in. And the idea is that there's some standardization between states. We have, of course, made Minnesota's. We've translated it into Minnesotan, as my team says. Over the past decade, there have been several data incidents at major non-Minnesota-based insurance companies that have exposed sensitive personal information on millions of consumers. After nearly 2 years of work, the NAIC adopted this Model Act in 2017, and 11 states across the country have already adopted it, with many others pursuing it this session. This law would apply to insurers, insurance agents, and other insurance-related entities that are licensed by the department. I'm happy to go through the bill in detail, but at a high level, the model asks insurance companies and insurance producer licensees to do three things. First, create a plan on how to deal with cybersecurity events. Second, work that plan. Investigate cybersecurity events if you think you have one, and if you do, notify the state and consumers when a cybersecurity event has happened. So these three requirements will increase the likelihood that companies are prepared for the internal and external data threats that they face and help consumers take immediate steps to protect themselves when private data is exposed. The department has worked collaboratively with stakeholders from the life, property and casualty, and health insurance industries, as well as the independent and health insurance agents and the bankers. From the input from individual companies and trade associations has been incorporated into this proposal as introduced, as well as into the author's amendment. I'd like to thank everyone who's worked on this bill. There have been a lot of it's been a lot of work, including when this was still a thing, a in-person meeting with I think most of the stakeholders at a single table, which seems novel at this point. So with the passage of this bill, we preserve the state's ability to act on behalf of Minnesotans in this space. The Department of Treasury has recommended prompt adoption of this model and has indicated that if states don't create some sort of uniformity across state laws by 2022, then there may be preemptive federal action. So with that, Chair Stevenson and members, I'm happy to walk through some of the details or stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Arnold. We do have one member of the public wishing to testify. It's Dan Andreessen. Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to quickly provide testimony. We appreciate the conversation we've had over the past few weeks with Representative Elkins and the department on this bill and hearing some of our concerns with the bill as introduced. These have been productive conversations, but these are still a bit of a work in progress and on several issues, mainly in Section 4 of the bill regarding notification of a cybersecurity event. Health insurers are already required to comply under HIPAA to notify consumers, reinsurers, third parties, and federal agencies if a data breach has occurred. We have requested an exemption to many of the requirements in this section, and we're still working out some of these details with the department. We would still comply with the language in Subdivision 1 and 2 of that section in notifying the department of a breach, but we do have concerns about having to do so within 3 days as written in the bill. As I said, we are having productive conversations and we'll continue to do so, but just wanted to get these concerns on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. There are no further public testifiers, so we will now have member discussion and question. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Elkins, any closing comments?
It's a pretty straightforward process. Good discussions will continue. Please vote yes.
All right, and would you like to renew your motion?
I will renew my motion that we refer House File 1913 to the General Register as amended.
All right, Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 1913 as amended. Oh, Representative Lucero, did you have a quick comment here?
Just a real quick question on clarification on the point that was just brought up by Mr. Andreessen.
All right, Representative Lucero.
Yep, so looking at, I was quickly scrolling to that section, and upon reading it, the third day requirement, so the question for Representative Elkins, is the third day notification, when I'm reading this, it appears to be, and I'm just looking for your confirmation, that the time clock to notify is upon the third day of discovery of the cyber, what do you term it, the cyber security event. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Representative Elkins, yeah. Representative Lucero?
Thank you. So, and I'll just put on the record then as well, since this is still a work in progress, that upon the discovery, if it's the third day upon discovery of a breach, right, they may still be, within the third day, they could still be trying to evaluate the scope of the breach.
Oh, yes.
3 days is really quick, right? And you don't necessarily want to, you may not have a full grasp of the totality of the breach, right? So just putting that on the record, that is a really, really short timeline given the size of some of these IT environments. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Representative Lucero, yeah. I agree with that. Usually you will not, within 3 days, have been able to assess the full array of the scope, but that's probably also true of 5 days. But you want to, you know, alert the department that we have a problem, we're investigating it, because in most cases the investigation may go on for weeks or farther, but you don't want to wait until you completely understand what's happened before you at least sound the alarm.
All right, Representative Elkins had renewed his motion right before Representative Lucero's question that House File 1913 as amended be recommended to be referred to be placed on the General Register. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Cortizo Watoon.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Representative Dabney.
Daphne, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
There being 17 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1913, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. The next file on the agenda today is House File 1915, Representative Rasmussen's bill. Representative Rasmussen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 1915 be placed on the General Register.
All right. Representative Rasmussen moves House File 1915 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move and describe your author's amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment incorporates the model regulations in the legislation in order to avoid the Department of Commerce needing to engage in rulemaking. This same amendment was adopted in the Senate unanimously, so we're just trying to match up language.
All right. Representative Rasmussen moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the A1 amendment. Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Rasmussen, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 1915 today. While we are going to be talking about reinsurance today, I want to be clear that this bill is not about reinsurance for the MNsure individual market. This bill doesn't touch that topic. The legislation before the committee doesn't have a fiscal note and deals with regulations on reinsurers. As committee members know, reinsurance is insurance for insurance companies, and reinsurance helps our Minnesota underwriters effectively manage risk. For example, the North Metro hailstorm in June 2017 brought with it $3.2 billion in damages. Minnesota property and casualty insurers used reinsurance to help pay claims while protecting their balance sheets. Minnesota's Department of Commerce regulates reinsurers, focusing on whether or not reinsurers have sufficient financial strength or collateral to meet their obligations. In 2017, the United States and the European Union entered a covered agreement that would eliminate unnecessary collateral requirements for reinsurers who meet certain regulatory criteria. States have until September 2022 to comply with the agreement's reinsurer collateral requirements, or they will face federal preemption. Federal preemption would mean that our Department of Commerce would lose its ability to regulate reinsurers to the federal government. In addition, the Department of Commerce would lose its NAIC accreditation, which means Minnesota insurance companies would need to seek regulatory approval in each state, which would put our Minnesota insurers at a significant disadvantage. The bill before the committee is the NAIC model legislation that would put Minnesota in compliance with the covered agreement and avoid federal preemption. A majority of states will pass this model legislation this year. Passing this before the September 2022 deadline is critical to Minnesota's insurers and is a priority for the Department of Commerce. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to give Commissioner Grace Arnold the opportunity to speak on the bill, and afterwards, Commerce staff and I are happy to take any members' questions.
Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Commerce. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Rasmussen for authoring these changes. We, to avoid confusion in the department, refer to this as reserve credit instead of the Reinsurance Model Act because it got too confusing for us. But as Representative Rasmussen mentioned, this is a model law. Again, these are laws that are vetted through the regulatory community and with industry input that helps. This particular model law helps to ensure strong non-U.S. insurers are available to provide capacity to manage U.S. insurers' catastrophic risks. Members may recall that the department, legislators, and industry worked together to enact the credit models in Minnesota in 2018. The current proposal reflects subsequent revisions to the model that are related to the trade agreements that Representative Rasmussen mentioned. This proposal eliminates minimal collateral provisions, and those are in place if there's a doubt of the financial strength of a counterparty. When collateral requirements are imposed, reduced capital flexibility results. The elimination of the required collateral is a recognition that a separate process to identify financially strong counterparties has been established, and that's through a certified insurer process. So parties can still agree to collateral provisions, but this provides some additional flexibility without compromising the strength of the companies. Failure to adopt these updates would subject Minnesota to federal preemption, as Representative Rasmussen mentioned. And so in addition to personally not wanting that on our department, we would lose jurisdiction and the right of granting reserve credit for Minnesota insurers. Representative Rasmussen mentioned that the model law and NAIC are an accreditation standard, so that means that other states can rely on our regulatory standing and the work that our team does when evaluating the financial security or the financial strength of companies. So if we don't have that, then other states can't rely on us. We would need to have that effective September 2022 to maintain our standing. The NASC model regulation revisions contain details on safeguards and documentation requirements, and those were included in the author's amendment. For context, most NAIC model laws have model laws and regulations to incorporate them all in. So we sort of save the step of rulemaking and allow the legislature to weigh in on the process. I'm happy to walk through the proposal or stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Arnold. Don't have any other public testifiers, though there are a number of people available for questions. Is there any member discussion or questions to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Rasmussen, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is important and time-sensitive legislation that will help Minnesota maintain its ability to regulate its insurance industry. I would ask for member support and appreciate the Department of Commerce's a thorough work on this issue. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion to place House File 1915 on the General Register.
Representative Rasmussen renews his motion that House File 1915, as amended, be recommended to be referred to be placed on the General Register. Mr. Brown will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Cortez-Watoon. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll votes aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson aye.
Representative Daphne, excused. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Representative Tice.
Aye.
And Vice Chair Cortez-Watoon.
Aye.
All right. There being 16 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1915, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. The last bill on today's agenda is House File 2083. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lippert. I will move House File 2083 be laid over for further consideration. Representative Lippert, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. To meet our climate goals as a state, we need to be addressing greenhouse gas emissions across our economy, especially in areas of our economy where emissions have stayed stubbornly flat or are still increasing, like in the transportation sector. House File 2083, the Future Fuels Act, is a technology-neutral and emissions-based policy that will reduce the carbon intensity of fuels and transportation, leading to the use of cleaner and cleaner fuels over time. A clean fuels policy like the Future Fuels Act is a key recommendation of Minnesota's Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council. According to their report, a policy like this that puts a clean fuel standard in place that steadily decreases the carbon intensity of fuels over time has been demonstrated to increase the use of lower carbon intensity fuels and encourage electricity as a transportation fuel as well. They also point to its ability to attract investment in emerging clean fuels technology like aviation biofuel. The goals of this policy include more than a focus on emissions reduction and economic development, but also on equity and broader environmental goals. This policy seeks to support equitable transportation electrification that benefits all communities and is powered primarily with low carbon and carbon-free electricity, improve air quality and public health, targeting communities that bear a disproportionate health burden from transportation pollution, and also to support voluntary farmer-led efforts to adopt agricultural practices that benefit soil health and water quality. There's a broad coalition behind this legislation supporting the implementation of a clean fuel standard that will reduce the carbon intensity of fuels by 20% by 2035. And I'll turn to the first testifier at this time, Mr. Brendan Jordan of the Great Plains Institute.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute, and I facilitate the Future Fuels Coalition. If you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I will just put one slide up on screen that just shows some of the membership of the Future Fuels Coalition and shows the broad support for a clean fuels policy in the state of Minnesota. This is a program that enjoys broad support, and it will have multiple benefits for the state. It builds on extensive stakeholder dialogue over the past 3 years by a number of stakeholders around the Midwest, and it has been recommended in several venues, including the Governor's Council on Biofuels and the Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council. There is momentum building for this approach with legislation moving in multiple states around the country, and there's a real opportunity for Minnesota to show leadership in this area and have influence beyond our borders. Mr. Chair and members, I will, in the interest of time, conclude my comments, but I'd be happy to take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Representative Lippert, did you want to introduce your next testifier? Or I can, it's up to you. You're muted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeremy Martin from the Union of Concerned Scientists is on.
All right, welcome to the committee, Mr. Martin.
Yes, thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. I am the Director of Fuels Policy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. On behalf of more than 6,800 UCS supporters in Minnesota, UCS is enthusiastic in its support for the Future Fuels Act. The Future Fuels Act takes a science-based approach that measures each fuel based on its full life cycle emissions. This will drive technological development and deployment across a portfolio of low carbon fuels, including electricity and biofuels. We can't stabilize the climate with petroleum-based transportation fuel, but replacing petroleum is a big job, and it requires us to move beyond arguments about biofuels versus electricity and drive progress and deployment across the board. By supporting emissions reductions rather than increased production, the Future Fuels Act, ensures that all clean fuels keep getting cleaner. Electric vehicles and biofuels are cleaner than gasoline today, but we need electric vehicles to be powered primarily with renewable energy, and we need our biofuels to get steadily cleaner with less pollution on the farm and at the refinery, biorefinery. The Future Fuels Act supports this. While the overall structure of the Future Fuels Act is technology neutral, fuel pathways are different and need specific guardrails and policy guidance. Support for electrification must be designed to benefit all Minnesotans, particularly those underserved and overburdened by today's transportation system. Safeguards are needed to protect natural lands and to ensure that support for farmers is equitable, benefiting small and mid-sized farms. We look forward to continued engagement with the committee, the legislature, the coalition, and the administration to make the Future Fuels Act a success. Thank you.
All right. Representative Lippert, did you want to introduce your last testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin Fay of Fresh Energy is with us as well.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Fay.
Awesome. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and exciting to be in your committee for the first time, I think. Good afternoon, members. My name is Justin Fay, and I'm here on behalf of Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nearly 30-year-old Minnesota-based nonpartisan nonprofit organization working to achieve equitable carbon-neutral economies. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today regarding the Future Fuels Act. Minnesota has made great progress in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector, but we have fallen behind in making similar progress in other sectors of the economy, especially transportation. Transportation is now the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, and the Future Fuels Act is one strategy that Fresh Energy supports for tackling this critical problem. Fresh Energy appreciates a number of features of this legislation. In particular, it balances the need to establish guiding principles to direct the outcomes of a future rulemaking without prescribing specifics of how such a program should be set up and managed. Such design elements and details should appropriately remain under the purview of a rulemaking process, given the number of stakeholders and interested parties involved and the general complexity of the program itself. The Future Fuels Act would make Minnesota the first state in our region to adopt a clean fuels policy. In addition to the emissions benefits from the bill, taking on a leadership role in this way sends a market signal that Minnesota is ready to do business with companies driving innovation in clean transportation technologies. That makes this a win-win for Minnesota. As the bill progresses, one area we believe warrants some additional discussion is the question of which agencies should be delegated to lead this rulemaking process. Fresh Energy's belief is that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has the right expertise in greenhouse gas emissions assessment and modeling and is likely in the best position to run this type of complex rulemaking process. We look forward to further conversation on this point. Reducing emissions from the transportation sector is an absolute imperative to meet Minnesota's climate goals. For this reason, Fresh Energy supports the Future Future Fuels Act, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about this important legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fay. We will now move to public testimony. One public testifier signed up. It's Peter Wiginius. Mr. Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Wiginius, Legislative Director of Sierra Club. At the heart of this proposal are two assumptions which are now out of date. First, advocates tout that it is technology neutral, which may have been a virtue at one time, but that is no longer a virtue when the technologies are not equal. Fully electric vehicles are superior in climate impact as well as air quality and environmental justice. Electric vehicles are already significantly less polluting today based on the current electricity supply, which is already greener than in the past. This existing advantage for EVs will only grow as our electric grid continues to improve. By contrast, the other fuels already pollute more than electricity, and they always will. This is not to say there's no role for biofuels in transportation's future, but it should be limited to heavier vehicles where no electric alternative exists. Advocates have acknowledged that the biofuels industry wants this bill to carve out a place for them in the future of transportation. That's understandable that they would need government to intervene on their behalf because technology and the free market, think General Motors, are currently passing them by. Policy needs to keep up with reality. Second, there is no need for additional rulemaking to accelerate adoption of EVs. That might be needed for reducing carbon in liquid fuels, but we don't need to overthink or bureaucratize EV policy. We can incentivize charging stations, incentivize purchase of EVs, and implement clean cars. Could a low-carbon fuel standard be an additional tool worth the time to develop? Theoretically, yes, if we could implement something very much like the California version, where they are, in effect, taxing big oil to pay for EVs. But it is unlikely the Senate would ever pass, nor the Walz administration would ever implement that version of a standard. Let me end on a positive. To the extent that this bill serves as an alternative to the E15 mandate, that is very useful, since ethanol doesn't reduce carbon so much as move it around. It also pollutes drinking water and kills pollinators at great financial cost, all while distracting us from real action on the climate crisis. For that reason, Sierra Club is not opposed to this bill, but is expressing these concerns, and we thank the authors for bringing forth an alternative to the E15 mandate.
All right, that is the end of public testimony to the bill. We'll now move to member discussion and questions. Representative Lucero. I think you're muted, Representative Lucero.
Can you hear me now?
Sure can.
Verizon, all right. I lost my train of thought there. Mr. Chair, if I understood the testifier from the Sierra Club, there's actually some items that I actually agree with. So that's shocking because generally I don't, but I appreciate some of those remarks. I don't believe that fossil fuels are a problem, and I don't believe that's a crisis that we need to use the government tax code or other incentives to change people's behavior. One of the things I'm very concerned about is the remark that I heard, rulemaking without specifics. There is no way I would ever support something with rulemaking without specifics, essentially ceding our legislative authority to the executive branch to develop whatever they wanted without our guidance. That is incredibly dangerous, as we've seen right now under a one-person rule, just creating law. I don't want to become a cold California, and that's what this seeks to do, is take California standards and make Minnesota a California, just much colder. We do not want that. And then lastly, I've been to California. I've got family in California. And when I visit out there, generally it's many, many dollars more per gallon fuel prices than Minnesota. And then when I leave California on my frequent road trips and I just cross the border, it is really, really enjoyable to watch the gasoline drop by $2.50 to sometimes $3 just by crossing the border, exiting California. So we do not want that. California is not something we should be mimicking and bringing here to Minnesota. So this is not a good bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero, Representative Haley.
Sorry, I'm trying to get my video. I guess it's not letting me get my video. So Representative Lippert, thanks for bringing the bill forward. This concept of a low carbon fuel standard originated in California, where I believe it's been law for a number of years. Can you tell me how much the policy has reduced the state's greenhouse gases and what the effect has been on fuel prices?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Haley. We were had a California economist with us on our testifier list, but Mr. Jordan may be able to answer that question.
Mr. Jordan?
Mr. Chair and members, I might actually defer to Jeremy Martin, although on the greenhouse gas reductions from the California policy, I will respond briefly on the issue of price impacts. We have done modeling for a Minnesota program, which is completely independent from a California program, completely under the control of Minnesota, not connected in any way to California or ceding any jurisdiction to California. But our modeling suggests that there would not be consumer price impacts from a Minnesota clean fuels program under the Future Fuels Act. And in fact, the modeling that we have commissioned suggests consumer benefits from increased availability of lower cost clean fuels. I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, Mr. Martin, but if you might be able to address the question about greenhouse gas reduction.
Mr. Martin, any comments on greenhouse gas reductions in California?
I don't have precise figures at my fingertips, but we can try to get some and send them to the record. It has substantially increased the use of low carbon and alternative fuels, and both increased the share of fuels that are alternative and low carbon fuels, and also driven progress where each of those fuels has gotten cleaner over time. And so each gallon of ethanol is delivering more emissions reductions now than it was 10 years ago, in part because of the support, because of the structure of the policy, which supports emissions reductions in addition to increased use of lower carbon fuels.
Before I return back to Representative Haley, since we're talking about fuel prices, I did just want to say I was struck by Representative Lucero's discussion of leaving California and seeing fuel prices drop by multiple dollars a gallon. So I went to online to see if that's accurate, that there's such a cliff. And as I look right now, according to AAA, the average price per gallon of gas in California is about $3.85 versus $3.22 in Nevada next door, which I assume would be the next stop on Representative Lucero's road trip back to Minnesota. So not quite there is a difference, but not quite the difference that maybe I misunderstood what Representative Lucero was saying too. And since I evoked his name, I should probably give him a chance to respond. Even though I'm cutting off Representative Haley, I will come back to you, I promise, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was a road trip 2 years ago, approximately, and so it's not right now. And when I was filling up with the rental car that I had, if I remember correctly, it was approximately $4.50-ish, something to that effect. And crossing the border, filling up, it started with a $2. So absolutely, there was multiple dollars difference.
Okay. Well, just to be clear, right now it's more like 50 cents. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not in favor of this proposal today. I think that if the objective is to reduce greenhouse gases, but we really didn't hear a clean answer on what's happened in California. And the information that I've researched on California fuel prices shows an increase of over a dollar a gallon. And Minnesota is a much different economy, quite much smaller than California. And also, we have a completely different climate. So I was surprised to hear the testifier say that, you know, this policy is completely independent of California when it is completely adopted after a California model. So I have many more concerns about this and concerns about our ethanol market here. But I know that we have a few more minutes here of committee. So I just wanted to get a few of those things on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Any additional discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Lippert, did you want to make some closing comments?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to respond briefly to Representative Haley as well, you know, there are multiple, just to reiterate, there are multiple states that have put a clean fuels policy like this in place. And the approach here is a specifically Midwestern one that would fit our strengths as Minnesota. We need to be addressing our climate goals. We need to have a comprehensive policy in place that can help us reduce emissions within transportation. This Future Fuels Act, this sort of policy will drive cleaner and cleaner fuels, drive cleaner biofuels, and drive more electrification. So it's a good policy for Minnesota. I appreciate the committee's time and ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2083 be laid over for further consideration. The bill will be laid over. And Representative O'Driscoll, you may have a procedural question here.
Mr. Chair, when the time is right, I just wanted, maybe now is the time. GOP members of the Commerce Committee, we will meet immediately after this meeting. Check your email for Zoom information and materials for that meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And we, I appreciate the efficiency and the consideration that members showed for our time today. As a consequence, there will be no need for our evening meeting tonight. So I will be able to watch The Voice with my children, which is great. So instead, I will see you all tomorrow. The meeting is adjourned.